Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world, and you're a part of it wherever you are. Shalom, and welcome to the Land of Israel Network, which is broadcasting amazing stuff to you from the Land of Israel to the world, to thelandofisrael.com. And shalom, and welcome to Rabbi Mike Foyer.
Hi, Yishai. How are you feeling?
How are you? I'm feeling I'm not 100% yet there, and I got a lot of emails from last week's show because I did it kind of on the couch. What with Malka, and I was sick at home with something I called a mini flu. I don't know what it was, but it was some kind of virus. My wife laughed at me afterwards and said that it's only because I actually had a cold, but because I'm a man, it's called a flu. Okay, that's what she said. Anyway, shalom and welcome to Spiritual Cafe as well. I'm back with Rabbi Mike Foyer today at Beit Midrash Pardes. We're at Pardes, pardes.org.il. Indeed, Rabbi Mike, we missed a Shmo together, that it was really fun to be with Malka. I hope I can catch you for the end of this show as well today. And we missed hanging out last week in this new book, A Total Transition.
A whole new world,
a totally different kind of Torah, let's call it that way. No longer the story of the forefathers and these powerful type Jewish characters, the Abrahams, the kind of world loving and yet tough Abraham who stands alone in this world, loves the world yet stands alone and embraces kind of God, a monotheistic God, the strong but silent yet kind of also laughing Yitzchak, on the one hand a kind of a silent character, and yet we learned that his name means laughter, and we kind of loving on the one hand, on the other hand kind of brooding. A character, and then Yaakov, a person with kind of two halves. He's Jacob. He's Israel. He's in the land of Israel, and he's excited, but he also knows how to work it outside of the land of Israel. The whole issue of the brothers, the love of Joseph, the sale of Joseph. Joseph becomes viceroy of Egypt. These very strong Jewish characters. Now we're going to a different book where the Jews are somewhat disempowered. They're going to be these slaves, and they take on a national character, which can be sometimes annoying, sometimes whining, complaining. Their greatness is a little subdued, and they have this new leader. His name is Moses, and at first, he also wants to subdue his potential greatness. He's going to be the greatest of the great. He's going to be number one, but at the same time, he kind of doesn't want the mission. He's dragged along a little bit, kicking and screaming, at the beginning in any case, and he's going to also falter with Pharaoh. He's going to falter with the fellow Jews. He's going to learn that Jewish politics is a dirty business, and the Bible as a book becomes this place where you're like, ooh, these Jews are a tough bunch.
I think that was actually apparent in the book of Genesis as well. I think the big shift here is one in scale, is that the sort of intimacy and gritty reality of the family is a very different scale of operations than the national sort of development you're speaking about, and the struggle and the sort of Cecil B. DeMille scale divine intervention that we're about to see. That to me is the big shift, and it doesn't surprise me that Moshe falters. I mean, it's one thing to say, listen, can you work out this mess at home? It's another thing to say, can you solve the world's problems? So I give a little empathy to him.
Yeah, but we're also going to meet an antagonist. I don't think we had one antagonist. Now for the first of the many Torah portions, we're going to deal with the anti guy, and that's Pharaoh. I don't know if we had one anti guy beforehand where we could kind of focus our. It's like a mano-a-mano. It's like a kind of a linear good guy bad guy fight between two forces.
That's also part of the shift, because if you were going to pick anyone in the Book of Genesis, it might have been Esau, but the reality is he's Yaakov's twin brother. In the end of the day, the resolution there is what we're after, not the conflict. Whereas you're right, Paro stands in opposition to Am Yisrael. He stands in opposition to God. Moshe is going to get in his face. They're going to stand in opposition to each other. And what will be born out of that is a completely different scale of divine relationship as well.
Yeah, I have to admit that I don't always have the easiest time with Exodus as a... I understand the forefathers very well. I understand the book of Leviticus, although I want to learn it deeper this year. Every year I say to myself, I want to learn it deeper and really get it more, get its messages to me of law. I certainly love the book of In the Desert or Numbers. you know, which is all about Jewish politics and the land of Israel and all these things. I like that book very. It's easy for me to connect it. And the what I call the Book of Jewish Philosophy, which is Deuteronomy. The book that is hardest for me, at least in parts, is these beginning chapters of Exodus.
Well, let's dig into it.
Yeah, let's do it. And I guess it's hard for me to deal with like a disempowered Jewish people.
I mean, it's very interesting that you that phrase is returned a few times in your language, disempowered. I mean, on some level, their very choice to survive and to thrive and to continue to be who they are in these terrible conditions is an act of tremendous agency. I wonder how you define empowerment.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good point you're making, and I think that brings up a lot. And I just want to mention a little Torah that I mentioned last week on my flu couch. There is something that Yisrael Meir Lau says about that the daughter of Pharaoh opens up this floating basket, this little ark. And she sees a crying boy. She sees the boy crying. And it should have said she heard him before she even opened it. And he says this very poignant thing. He says, in the Holocaust, we learned how to stay silent even though we were crying as children. And she saw that it was a crying child who was staying silent. She's like, it's a Hebrew. That's who it is. You know, it's like when he said that, I remember when I first heard that the first time in my life, I was like, oh my God, that is so scarily true. It's like Yisrael Meir Lau, he's the kind of person who's going to say this kind of thing.
Oh gosh, yeah, and it really brings to mind that sort of turning point moment in redemption when God heard our cry. Meaning, it's all well and good when it comes to need for survival, and God forbid we should ever know from such things as the Holocaust, as Rav Lau is explaining. But at a certain point, things are so bad that the consequences don't matter anymore. You just have to cry out. And I feel like that really was the turning point there in Mitzrayim, is that all the constructs, all the reasons we had to play it safe, keep it small, be quiet, suffer, quiet, whatever it is, no more. I can take no more. And that crying out is really what triggers the process that we're going to get into in this week's Parsha.
Right. I just want to say that my issue with these Torah portions is the same issue I have with the Passover Haggadah, which I don't always understand why it's written the way it's written and not in a more linear fashion and all that. In any case, the first big chapters of the book of Exodus is called Shmot, the names of the Jewish people who came down to Egypt, and that was till about chapter 6 in the book of Exodus. By the way, Exodus, a more fitting name seemingly than Shmot, which means names. It's Exodus. That's what the book is about. Exodus. Good on you.
Moving all the people.
Right. Movement of your people. That's right. Here in this week's Torah portion, after Moses has already gone to Pharaoh for the first time, he's had, you know, he what's it called? He spoke truth to power.
That's right.
Right. But power pushed right back on him.
It said, put a lid on it.
Right. That's what you got to know about truth of power, right?
It doesn't always end well.
Right. It's not going to be like, you should know that when you stand up and you're like, you say the truth, don't be expecting it.
There's a lot of that going on in the world right now.
Right now. Like, for example, we're like America is going to declare that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. And the other side's like, you're going to be unleashing hell. I like how they said that. I'm just like I thought for the all the
like, don't hold back.
Yeah, I thought the whole time you were unleashing heaven here, and now it's gonna turn to hell from here.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, there's definitely going to be pushback. Don't ever think that the other side just rolls right over. But anyway, after that first trial by fire, there's going to be a little soliloquy of God here. This is reminiscent of a few places in the Torah where there's going to be a kind of 10-part blessing. It's going to be like there's going to be a few times in the Torah where God's going to be like, this is what it could look like, okay? If you want it, this is what it's going to look like. And it's very, very moving. And it basically says, listen, God says, I showed myself to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in a certain name through a name called El Shaddai. But however, my name, the Tetragrammaton, I really did not totally reveal to them, okay?
Well, I just want to call you up on that grammar there. Is if Shmi Hashem lo nodati lahem does not mean lo hodati lahem, right? I mean, what you said is lo hodati lahem. I didn't make known to them. I wasn't known to them in this way, right? Because Abraham and Yitzchak and Yaakov knew the Tetragrammaton.
The Tetragrammaton appears many, many times.
And it says Avram called out, Kara B'Shem Hashem, he called out. But that's why Rashi, the classic commentator, and many of the other commentators here have to pick up and say, well, what does it actually mean for this name to be known to them? It means that each name of God really is reflective of some mode of relationship between creator and created.
Right.
And here the Shem Hashem, that four-letter name of God, is the name, as Rashi points out here, that indicates that God makes good on all promises. Meaning that God is not bound by any external circumstance. If he promised Abraham the land would be his, if he promised that the children of Israel would be redeemed, these things will happen by definition. And Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov lived in the process where they received the promise, but they never saw its fulfillment. And that's really what it means, that they knew me as Kel Shaddai, right? And the one who says to the world, die, enough. These are the boundaries, these are the borders. But Moshe, what triggered this whole incident? How did we get, why is God sort of like giving Moshe a little patch and explaining to him how?
Or a little pep talk.
A little bit of both, because in the end of last week, Parsha, when Moshe spoke truth to power, and Paro said, well, I'm going to show you why they call me power. Here you go, right? Now you talk truth to God. Get out of my palace, right? Moshe came back to God and says, Lama Hariota. Like, why did you make things worse? I thought you sent me here to save these people. And God basically says to him, Chaval al Davdin, right? Like, where are the people who used to be around in last book that we love so much, who, when I told them something was going to happen, they didn't worry about how that was going to work, and what would it look like, and what if it doesn't look like we're heading in that right way? They just knew, I promised. This and Moshe, because he's in the thick of this process, finds it much more difficult to hold the process. And I think that at the risk of talking modern day politics, this is the disease that plagues the national religious world today, is that for so long in our history, emuna, faith meant, no matter what, we're with God. And somewhere in the recent last 100 years, that was shifted to, no matter what, God's with us. And so the problem with that is that when it doesn't look like God is with us, where does your faith go? Right? And it is so crazy. I think of this all the time. We're all complaining, oh, they're going to move the embassy, and what about the Iranians and the Palestinians, and oh, it's so bad, I'm going back to America. God forbid. Right? People give up. They give up. And you say to yourself, well, what would you have done if you lived in the 15th century, you know, in Poland? Like, how could it be that people lack the faith now that they had then? When the answer is because back there in the 15th century in Poland, they were completely in the dark. They had the promise, just like Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, but there was almost no way to imagine how it would be fulfilled. Now that we're actually in the heat of the process transforming into the product, and Moshe's there, he's been sent by God. God said, this is it. You're going to redeem them. But he can't hold the process anymore. And that's why God says to him, listen, I'm showing you my full name, but you gotta accept what that means and the responsibility.
I like that very much, what you're saying. And I think another way of saying your critique on society today is the following very, very simple formula. You said it one way, I'm just tweaking it a different way, which is, does God work for you or do you work for God?
Yep.
Which one is it, you know? And I think that particular formula is if you like think about that formula and think to yourself, does he work for me or do I work for him? It really will change everything about your life. Hmm. when you just focus in on that question. It just changes your decision making.
Do I get vacation days?
And you know what? But even if, for example, I want to comment on that, which is that's the same thing what I tell people about vacationing in the land of Israel. When you're vacationing in the land of Israel, you're not running away. You're not being a Yonah and running away. You're actually still in the process. You're still in his kingdom. You're taking a little pressure off.
You're shifting modes.
Right, shifting modes. You're seeing the land of Israel. You're blessing him for different things. He's giving you a time to air out. And you're still part of it. You're still very much part of it because you're still working for him. Anyway, so I like what you said. I would say only that maybe it was a little bit like, there's a pep talk here. It's like, you sent in the rookie. You know,
he had a hard first round,
right? He totally airballed, you know, the 3-pointer or whatever it was, or he got smacked down by Patrick Ewing or whoever it is, you're like, oh, but you see a lot of potential there. Kid's got potential. Pulling him over, you're like, listen, look, this is the way it's gonna be. It's exactly what you said, which is like, okay, I'm gonna help
this
you.
This is gonna happen. Don't worry.
It's gonna happen. And And what he does in these verses, personally, I want to tell you that I see here 10 languages or 10 words that represent this whole process of God's. And basically he says that I was with the forefathers. I will fulfill my promise to them to bring their children to give them the land of Israel. I heard the outcry of the children of Israel as Egypt is enslaving them. I will remember my covenant. Therefore, tell the Jewish people, "V'hotzeti etchem mitachat tziv." I will take you out from the bondage of Egypt. I will save you from their harsh labor. I will redeem you with a strong hand and with great miracles. I will take you to be my nation, and I will be a nation unto you, and you shall know that I'm your God who takes you out of the bondage of Egypt. I'm going to bring you to the land which I originally created for you from the get-go, to give to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, and I'm going to give it to you. Here's, by the way, one of the little proofs that it's much more than just four languages that we talk about on Passover, on Pesach, on the Seder night of Hotzeti Vitzati V'Galti V'Lakachti. It's also V'Heveti. Everybody knows that. But it's also V'Natati. I will bring you to the land, but that's not enough. We live right now in a time where God has brought us to the land, but he hasn't given it to us yet fully, right? So there's also a V'Natati. I will give it to you. You will not only come here and look at, let's say, for example, today where I live, I'm here, but I'm looking at a Muslim shrine on top of the Temple Mount. And finally, God says, I will give it to you as a morasha, as an eternal inheritance.
So what do you think it takes actually to receive? And it's an interesting point you're making, which I'll also very much relate to, that we're here, Baruch Hashem. But, and yet, there is a sense of like that, we're kind of like floating up just a little bit above the surface. So what do you think it actually takes to receive? If God's saying, I'll give it to you, then apparently what's preventing us is our ability to receive.
Well, I didn't think of it that way. I mean, but I think of it more of what you said earlier, which is like, believe that there's yet another stage. Like, don't give up now after Natati. It's like he ran us through the whole cycle of Jewish history, and now we're at, you know, between Veveti and Natati. Like, where there's another stage. Believe that. Believe that there's yet another stage. I sense that we're walking around without full consciousness of how big the time that we're living in is.
Yes.
I sense that all the time, and I could just feel that there's just other levels of consciousness that are possible.
No question.
And there are like little mini glimpses of it. Like sometimes for me, I'm talking about my life where it's busy and it's the phone is calling, and just now somebody was important was calling me, and whatever it is. It's just like there's a lot of confusion. There's a lot of like busy work, but there are sometimes these moments, and you're like. You know, these mini, mini, mini prophet moments, mini prophetic moments, and you're like, ooh, there's a totally different layer here possible.
Well, I feel like at a certain level, you have to go crazy. Because what we call normalcy is that life that Thoreau said, a life of quiet desperation. Right? We've spoken about this death of 1,000 cuts before, right? It's the death of 1,000 emails, meaning there's a world in which that we live, which is very normative and structured, and it's sound and it's clear and it's rational and it's dead. And there's glimmers of a consciousness today which is completely insane. It's completely insane. And I think back to like my decisions of coming here and the deep conversations I was having with God about, well, where do I really belong in the world? And the very clear answer I got, which is like, you belong there. And I think now, you know, it can be a real challenge with 3 jobs, 5 kids, you know, a mortgage and all that stuff. But here, I'm here. Well, okay, God's saying, yeah, but I haven't given to you yet.
Right.
You're here, but don't lose sight of how you got here. Because the goal is not just to be here. The goal is to strike root and grow and bring redemption.
When the question is between black and white, between Exodus from Egypt, you know, that and you know Jewish history, you know, better than me about this for sure. Like the breaking out of the Exodus, there's a clarity to it.
Yes.
It's once you get here when it becomes you know, when you get to a closer resolution, that's when it becomes tighter. And we know this also about righteous people, that becoming righteous is one thing, but then the continuing refinement past that,
yeah,
is where it becomes really hard and complicated. The story of the Jews in the land of Israel, that's the complicated one. That's the one when we don't naturally bandy together. That's the one where when we infight and especially now when we're coming to the land of Israel, all of our Judaisms look so different.
Yes.
So different. I don't know if I got a chance to tell you about this. I came back from England, and one of the things that I noticed about England was that whatever their tale is, it has a certain unified flavor from 1500 years ago till now. It has a certain kind of, and I'm always amazed, by the way, at these movies, the Harry Potter movies,
uh-huh,
that they are nothing but a continuing extension of the way these people have their tales, yep, and their things forever and forever. When my wife and I were on the train and we saw horses, regular people's horses covered in the sweaters, the same kind of sweaters that they were covered in for the last 1500 years in the same kind of farms in the same kind of places, it was like, oh, these people have a continuity, okay? Yeah. Our Judaism is confusing. We don't know who we are, what we sound like, what we look like, what are, as we say in Yiddish, what are zaches, what are...
Well, it's funny you say that, because as I'm struggling to absorb the new Jewish historians, like the sort of postmodernist cultural historians in particular, so their whole zach...
Is like Benny Morris, by the way?
No, he's particularly Israeli.
Because I happen to have sat on a panel with him recently.
No, I'm talking about the Americans in Boyarin and Ruderman and Bialy. These guys are very intelligent, writing, I think, quite profound observations about Jewish history, but their whole zach, as you say, is there is no zach. There's no Judaism. There are Judaisms. Right, it's this whole approach to denying any unifying continuity, and while there is truth to that, at the same time, I feel like I'm already seeing a pushback, because, like, well, if you pick your head up out of the trees, you'll notice there is a forest there. We are sitting in the land of Israel. I mean,
we are people.
We like, you know, like we're the same holidays. I mean,
same
like,
language.
And yet it's true. You can, if you push hard on any particular piece there, it'll separate off, and you can give a whole backstory about how this one was this and that was that, and the rabbis never really had any power, and the temple was this. But whoa, pull back the lens even just slightly. You say, give out, there's quite a story here. And so, like, this is what I'm after, and that's why my podcast is called The Jewish Story. I'm not actually interested in the reductionist project of history, of getting at the pieces of things. I want to see the picture, but make it true. I don't want to just, I'm not telling fairy tales. I believe we have a real story. And I feel like what you pointed out, by the way, is so clear, that this phase of Exodus is so clear and powerful because of that power of Hitnagdut, of the opposition. Like you pointed out, Paro is a new element in our story, and that makes me nervous, because there is a comfort in having an enemy.
Oh, having an enemy is awesome.
Well,
having an enemy is awesome. Having a Hitler, Yimach Shemo V'Zichro, may his name be blotted out forever. Like, to have that, to have a Haman.
Yeah.
And P.S., to have, you know, and I don't mean to get overly political, but to have an Obama, you know, it gave a lot of, some of us, not everybody, but it gave us like a clarity of what we have to be not, what we have to fight against. No question that for people in elements of the right wing are like nervous right now, because now we're being
balls
called
in
upon,
our court.
The ball's in our court. And in general, like, and... Yeah. Also, when there's a super bad guy, and there's utter destruction, you just have an inner force that says rebuild and build and do.
Moral clarity.
Right.
Yep.
Right. Okay. Speaking of moral clarity, I'm going to take a pause now, right, to read a little email from Chris. Chris is a Texan Gentile. Okay, that's what he calls himself, Texan Gentile. By the way, speaking of Texan Gentile, I got an email from an Arab friend of mine who calls himself, listen to this formulation, I love this. This is my new thing, Palestinian Zionist. Not a Palestinian Israeli, not a Palestinian Zionist. That's what he calls himself. I was just like, Palestinian Zionist. That is exactly what I'm talking about. That's the people I'm talking about. That's these people that want to be part of Israel, that accept that there's a Jewish state here. They may be an other, and they know themselves to be an other.
You know, they cherish their own identity.
But they also understand that he's not a pro-Israel. He's a Zionist.
He understands that the Jewish people need to be re-embodied.
I love that. So speaking of that, back to Chris, who is a Texan Gentile. And Texan is, of course, also...
A category unto itself.
Right. It's also an important identity. So he writes about Fiddler on the Roof.
There's a fiddler on the roof.
He's been a little bit upset that I've mentioned Fiddler a few times. So he writes, so, dot, dot, dot. You've mentioned Fiddler on the Roof a few times. I have a possibly different take on it. It seems like it's a Hollywood's secular attempt to make Jewishness seem outmoded, antiquated, pathetic, and passé, fighting in vain against modernity. No, don't get me wrong. I enjoyed the entertainment value and the rich slice of life it reveals. About a week after seeing it for the first time in my adult life, I started realizing, wait, something's askew with the message, the takeaway of the movie. The old matchmaker lady was just basically a self-serving, cunning buffoon paid by an old man to get young ladies. They just hit you over the head with the fact that you're a Luddite if you cling to tradition rather than change with the times. The big lovable father figure was totally pushed around by the domineering wife and his daughters, who are all finally liberated by breaking their father's will. I don't know, Yishai. Seems the whole thing was a hit piece designed to fuel the liberal, secular stereotypes, thereby fueling the self-hate and embarrassment of Jewishness, but all wrapped up in beautifully packaged song and dance and fine acting. If I'm right, then the movie's a kind of, well, a slap in the face. Hey, man, I'm just a Torah-pursuing Texan Gentile that loves God, my Jewish brothers and sisters, and the land, and maybe I'm off on this movie critique. Curious to know, do you think that I'm totally wrong here? Shalom, Chris.
So, Chris, you are
is that
unbelievable. First of all, you have a career ahead of you as a movie critic.
Yeah.
But you're 99% correct. And the only piece you're missing is that Hollywood, of course, didn't create the story. Right, that it was actually the Haskalah that created the story. That it was the Jewish Enlightenment, Shalom Aleichem, the great Yiddish writer who wrote the original Tevye the Milkman stories that became Hollywood Fiddler production of Fiddler on the Roof, was precisely doing what you're speaking about. That he was not even subtly attempting to use the hammer blows of modernity to crack what he perceived to be the crust of tradition that was preventing the Jewish people from achieving liberation in the modern Western sense. And so I think that, with the exception of the fact that you just didn't happen to know that they didn't write the script, that your analysis is very sound. At the same time, I think if you look closely, you will see within the movie the sense that Shalom Aleichem was a more complicated character than that himself as an author. And therefore, he was portraying, I'd say, a more... more unclear, a less clear, a less clear picture of it. Because if you look, I think to me, the most powerful expression in that movie actually comes in Tevye's song, If I Were a Rich Man.
If I were a rich man, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum.
Because it's true, his wife pushes him around and his daughters are breaking free. And in that presentation, he wishes he had a house so his wife could be happy. So, but what does he want for himself? Remember what it is?
Sure, of course.
He wants to sit and learn the holy books.
That's right. He wants a seat by the Western Wall. And they says that's the sweetest thing of all. And when he says that, for me personally, there's like a shudder. It's a choke-up moment. He means it. He means it. And I would say further, the rabbi is always presented as a kind of wise person, a really wise person. Funny.
Yeah.
And a little bit weak maybe, but also there's
but
a wisdom.
Wisdom.
There's wisdom there. And I wouldn't say that he's always pushed around by his daughters. The famous dream sequence is basically him pushing back and saying, you know, I want what's good for my daughter. I'm not going to force her, not because of only of tradition, but because I really do want her goodness. And may I also add that he's always talking to God, and you
yes.
never take that for it. Never is silly. It's never a joke. God is never a God is real to Tevye, and you believe him at the end of the movie.
And the last thing, and then I want to tie it back around to the sitting by the Western Wall. Is that, how does the movie end? You remember?
Can I tell you something about that? Before
yeah.
I'll answer you honestly. I oftentimes can't get to that part of the movie.
It's a long film.
Well, that's not why. I just, it's too
heartbreaking.
It's too heartbreaking.
Right.
And I don't go there, and I don't always watch it with my kids, just to see the, you know, one of the daughters marry a Gentile, one daughter going to the gulag, to the Soviet thing, and them being evicted from town. It's way, way real.
Mm-hmm.
It's way real. And
that's where I think the sort of subversive within the subversive of Shalom Aleichem comes out. Because he's basically saying, listen, we need modernity, needs to crack the shell of tradition, we need to liberate. At the same time, you should be aware of what it is you're was waiting for you there.
Right.
Jail, intermarriage, expulsion.
Right.
And yet, Tevye maintains this oh-so-important message. And this is, as far as I can tell, this is what Am Yisrael has to offer to the world, especially today. That when the world is so suffering for a new theory of value, a new standard by which to construct with all our incredible powers that humanity has today. We're floundering in the face of so many issues because we're reaching back to the Middle Ages to try to figure out how to like organize our societies. Is that what we have is a real value in that. It's a love of two things, wisdom and God, right? And it's one of the things I always, when I look at the Haredi part of our society, I always am in awe of their society and the fact that they've succeeded. And it's not like there's no consumerism there and there aren't social problems and all that stuff. You know, that's human business. But they have constructed a society which is built around a value which is completely other than what standard Western society is. It's a society which is built around the value of Torah.
Mm-hmm.
And the very idea that you could organize human beings not to meet their personal needs, not so they can consume ever-increasing amounts of goods, and not so they can like exercise power to suppress other, but because of the pursuit of Torah and God, tells me that Am Yisrael is holding the key for helping humanity reorganize this beloved planet. And I think that, so, I mean, the critique is sound. It's just there's I think you need to put Shalom Aleichem in his full context in order to appreciate that the only reason Am Yisrael needs to crack our shell of tradition to move forward is to push the story forward. And that's about a redemption. It's never about just absorbing into the society around us. Because that's why he ends, that's why the movie ends the way it does, in my opinion.
Do you know that my mother told me that there's an alternative ending in the Shalom Aleichem books for Tevi that he goes to the Holy Land?
Yes.
So there is also a Zionist, you know, there's a communist, there's a Zionist, there's the intermarriage. There's all that. I want to say to Chris, as a Torah-loving Gentile, I want to say to him as a Jew from Eastern Jerusalem, that I feel very comfortable showing this movie to my daughter. And think about the songs. Think about the songs for a second. Every song, you know, every song has a value. For example, Sunrise, Sunset, very moving song. There's something very true about it. And I can tell you as a Jew that I feel like that movie is able to pass on a certain kind of Yiddishkeit. And I hear that critique 100%, and yet somehow I still think that it comes out on the side of like, Yiddishkeit is beautiful. Yiddishkeit is passed on through the generations. That is what I think the value of that movie is. But anyway,
awesome email.
Right, awesome email. Exactly, Chris. Thank you very, very, very much. All right, we're here at Spiritual Cafe, Rabbi Mike Foyer. We're talking about the biggest things, and there's a lot of words to use, but that email is tied into this Torah portion.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it has to do with this question of. Of that scale of operation. What I hear Chris saying is that, wait, he called this like a hit job. Like, are they trying to knock you off mission?
Right.
Right, in the same way that I think what Moshe, to a certain degree, balks, and you can call it a pep talk or you can call it a little bit of a potch, whatever you want, God's saying to him, no, this is big. This is really big. And therefore, it's not like anything else.
By the way, my kids love one of my not favorite songs, which is Wonder of Wonder, Miracle of Miracles. Like, they just...
Wonder of wonders, miracle of miracles, God took a Daniel once again, stood by his side, and miracle of miracles, walked him through the lion's den.
And that song is all about, like, great miracles happen, and look, a miracle has happened to me. I get to marry my beloved.
Yeah.
Something very, very pure about that, and I don't think... My radar knows very well to kind of sense when somebody's trying to attack my, you know, the solid foundations of the things that I believe in. Mm. And I just don't feel that movie does that. And it's also very real. There's a lot of true Jewish pain in that movie. Anyway, that's the way I see it. But Chris, thank you again very much. Back to the Torah portion, Rabbi Mike Foyer. We're gonna now enter into plagues zone. Okay, we're gonna dip our finger in the wine, and there's gonna be plagues. There's gonna be these wonders, right, that are gonna happen in Egypt, and they're going to try to get into the heart of Pharaoh. Okay, we're gonna have these plagues. I myself always I struggle to understand what these plagues exactly mean. But there first, before we get to the plagues, there's this kind of there's a word that I learned recently, provenance, not providence, provenance, like where something really comes from,
mm-hmm.
where its real rooting is. There's like a seal that happens in a few verses that's like, this is Moses and Aaron. They are the ones who stand before Pharaoh. It's them, the Levites. That's who they are. That's them standing in front of Pharaoh.
They did it.
There's like a authentic
stamp
that happens.
Seal
there.
Of it,
right? The Torah is going to be like, these are the dudes. This is how old they are. This was real. And there's a lot of times in the Torah that it wants to say, like, don't take me as a joke. I'm not a book of fairy tales. This really, really happened. And then they're going to start the plagues. Last week, because I was sick, I got a little bit confused, but it's the staff is going to turn into a snake. Here, the Egyptian wizards are going to do the same. Of course, our snake eats their snake, okay?
While it's a staff.
Right. What do you mean by that?
According to the Midrash, that when it turned back into a staff, then it ate their snakes.
Uh-huh.
Just to make it like even uh-huh. more dramatic.
Right, right. And there's going to be these plagues. The first one is a big one, which is turning the Nile, the god of Egypt, into blood.
Yes.
What I mean, that must have been, I would have saved that one for last. That's like a big one, no?
The question of the sequencing of the plagues and whether they're meant to build on each other or what exactly they're approaching is a huge question.
Right.
So I don't know if I can answer the timing. I mean, they're all dramatic. I think they're all dramatic. I think that there's a subtlety, actually, to water and blood. You know, I mean, if you opened up your crystal clear tap right now and blood came out, you would be pretty surprised. But Nile's a pretty muddy river. People were used to kind of a less cleanly environment. So I don't know how much of a transformation at first glance. Also, this whole, like with the Midrash, plays up the idea that for the Jews it remained clean water and for the Egyptians that it was blood. I mean, a lot of this has to do with the beginning of God separating. There's so much of this. There's a process of separation that happens to these plagues, which is powerful. And, you know, the Sfas Emes, the great 19th century Hasidic master, teaches actually in the name of his grandfather, Chiddush Arim, but that the whole structure of the plagues, you know, there are 10 plagues, and of course there are 10 commandments. And he points out that there's another 10, an earlier 10, which are the 10 ma'amarot, the 10 sort of speakings, sayings, which God used to create the world. So he says that the 10 plagues come to remove the cover off of those 10 sayings and reveal the 10 commandments. That the plagues are meant to sort of remove a certain veil from creation and ready the world to receive commandment. Right? And that's the way, when I see each of these things, that's the way I relate to it. I mean, we could pick each apart individually, but as an overall frame, I think it's very important, because up until now, for most of the world, creation was the big moment. And it's kind of been going on its own. Okay, Avram got saved from a fiery furnace, or you know, there was this particular, you know, small miracle over there, and God spoke to this guy. But the idea of removing the veil, of saying, no, this is what creation actually is. I'm here, says God. I didn't wind up the world and walk away, right? I'm here, and I have a vested interest in your behavior. And therefore, I'm going to point out to you, once you get to Sinai, exactly how it is that you can make your way in this world successfully. This is a revolution of a scale which won't be repeated. So I'm tempted to get into the particulars, but I think it's important to think a little bit about what these plagues are in general.
And the plague famously kills the fish.
Yes.
And the fish are going to, there's going to be a few times in this plague sequence that there's going to be stinkiness.
Yep.
Egypt is going to stink a few times.
Yeah, there's rot. There's a rot going on.
There's a
on
rot,
here.
Right. It's going to smell bad, too. Not only is there going to be unpleasantness, but there's going to be a smell in the air. Anybody, by the way, who has ever smelt like dead animals in the field or something like that, it could be really, really horrible.
Oh, yeah.
It's a horrible, horrible smell. It really can, like from a long distance, can just totally change your... Like, I remember I was in the Army one time in some field, and we were at some distance from some kind of animal, like a cow or something that had died, and just... It was. I couldn't take it. It was like so
it's
upsetting.
It's beyond the smell. There's something visceral about the smell of death that goes well beyond just the stink of it.
And it's not. I mean, death under the ground is fine, right?
Well, yeah, because like, then it's returning to the soil.
But right,
it's
but
death
like,
above when it's just. Yeah, yeah, I hear you.
And that is the death also of the Nile, the Nile, the life giving thing. The next thing is the frogs. Frogs are coming up, right?
That's my favorite, personally.
Yeah, it's my favorite also. I'm always, I mean, I love the frog. The frogs are just like, because you're like, frogs are kind of cute, and you like to see frogs if possible. So, but suddenly these frogs are like overdoing it.
Yeah, you don't want them filling your oven and
you don't want
in
them
your bed and
right. They're everywhere. I don't. What does that even mean? What's a frog? Why a frog? What is a frog supposed to tell me?
What's the message there?
And then again, the frog is going to die. Oh, and here's the best part: the necromancers and the wizards, they too can bring frogs. It's like, right. But they don't know how to get rid of them.
Right.
They don't know how to get rid of them. They're just like, when they hit their magic powers, it's like, oh, more frogs.
That
great.
Was a good move. Yeah. See, we can do this too. Moshe's
yeah,
thinking.
And everybody's
great.
Like, you see, we could do it too. But we can't get rid of these guys, right? And the frogs are going to die according to Moses's kind of timing. And that's another little proof. At each point, we see a kind of, the frogs are going to be gathered. You remember those in the tri-state area, probably wherever you're from also, like, the snow gets gathered into these giant piles,
mm-hmm.
and then at the mall, still in March.
You call them urban glaciers.
Right, and they're still there
in
March,
and
you're like, I can't believe it's still, it's like hot like anything out here, and there's like a pile of
and
snow.
And a trickle of dirty water coming off.
Yeah. Right. I forgot about that. So you got the stinky dead
piles
frog
of frogs.
Pile. Ooh, blah, blah, blah. I don't want that. And slowly but surely, like more and more, we see that Pharaoh has these moments where he says, "You're right and I'm wrong." At some point, he even says, "You're the righteous, your God is righteous, and I am wicked." He admits it at some point. The next one,
but not really,
right? But he always turns around and his heart is hardened.
He hardens his own heart at this stage.
Right.
Let's just remember that, because it's a common misconception, because God has said, already told Moshe, I will harden his heart.
Right.
But it's important to remember that is itself a response to Pharaoh's refusal to respond, really, to what is happening around him in anything other than sort of a symbolic fashion to get away whatever it is that's bothering him.
Right. So chapter 8, verse 11, it says that Pharaoh saw that there was some respite. And yes, he hardened his heart. He didn't. He listened to them like God said he wouldn't. Next one is the
lice.
By the way, when I think about lice, I remember my wife's grandmother, Kate, who went through Auschwitz and camps that she described as worse, at points that she described that their prayer on their lips was, God, please take my life already. Like, I want to be dead. I don't want this. Like, that was... I remember when she said that to me, I couldn't believe it. I'm like, do you pray to God to die? She's like, I wanted to die. One of the things that she described was that when they came to a certain camp, they gave them clothes that were completely lice ridden, and their whole bodies were filled with lice. And she said that was an impossible thing to survive. It was just so bothersome. And she prayed to God to die, but he didn't listen to her, thankfully. The wizards in this point, this one cannot copy the lice. Something is beyond them. They say to Pharaoh, this is the finger of God.
Yeah,
okay?
Etz be'Elohim.
Right. And he would not listen to them. There is the Arov. What is the Arov? The plague of like animal plague?
That's the way it's usually understood. Yeah. Mixed beasts.
Mixed beasts. They're coming in. And what does that mean? That just means like a bunch of wild animals. There's no
lions
more
and tigers and bears.
They're,
oh my!
They're right. They're not afraid of you anymore. They're not afraid of what you've your city or your peoplehood. They're just
right. And it's that element of fear is an important one, since we see all the way back from the beginning of Bereshit, this notion of what it means to be a human being is actually you will strike fear in the animals. That there's when a human being connects to the divine element within them, and their face really shows. We say, you know, that wisdom illuminates the face, right? So this is indicative of the lowly state of the Egyptians. The animals no longer see them as anything other than prey, right? They're not some superior species.
And maybe that's an irony that the Egyptians are seeing sheep as gods, and now like sheep or other animals don't even see them as people.
Mm.
You know, you're like you've totally debased yourself.
And that's part of what these plagues are: is they're just knocking out all of the things on which Egypt has grown to rely, you know, on the Nile, on the natural order of the world, on their relationship to the animals, until ultimately their very lives. And by the way, even though Am Yisrael isn't directly affected, it's also knocking out anything which we may have come to mistakenly rely upon. Because in the end of the day, the message here, of course, is I am not a messenger. I am not an angel. That's what God says, is that this is me. There is no other. Even though you live in a world filled with all these powers, understand that they work on my behalf.
And that there's a separation between you and the children of Israel.
For sure. For sure. And
it's a recurring theme.
It's a recurring theme, and it gets specific designation, I think, if I recall correctly, by the Dever, by
the plague,
cattle plague,
right?
Or the cattle plague. I'm just looking right now for the verse. Yeah, here it is. And there was a problem that says V'hifla Hashem ben mikne Yisrael ben mikne Mitzrayim. I'm in the ninth chapter on the fourth line that God made a distinction between the cattle of Am Yisrael and the cattle of Mitzrayim in case they'd missed it. And then it even says, V'yishlach Paro v'hineh lo meid miknei Yisrael ad achad. Right? And Paro wanted to check that one out. It says, oh, wow, none of the Jews' cattle died.
Right, because it's okay if it's like a tragedy, we're all part of it.
Right, well, you can always write things off to natural causes. And this is like, of course, I don't know if anybody listening to us has this thought right now, but, you know, this is a very old argument of people who, on one hand, dismiss this as a fairy tale. On the other hand, say, no, there were natural explanations for all these things. It was the climactic shifts, it was, you know, this and stuff. And then there's people say, just read the story. Right? That's, personally, I fall out there. Like, this idea that somehow you can affirm the story by demonstrating natural mechanisms by which such things could happen, in my opinion, misses the point entirely.
Well, that's exactly what they're doing. That's exactly
that's what the Egyptians
that's
themselves
what the Egyptians
are doing.
That's exactly what they're doing. They're like, you see?
Right. The question is God real and present or not?
Right.
That's what this story is about.
Oh, you're talking about those people who like say, like, you see, exactly on this date there was an earthquake, and that exactly explains the splitting of the Red Sea.
Which, I mean, that's great. That's fine. That's wonderful. So, but all you're doing is talking about mechanism as opposed to meaning. This is like it's a very important distinction for me in the relationship to the Torah at all. Right? Is that you know, I have my first degree is in geology, actually. And when I began to teach in yeshivot, many of my students, when they discovered I also had a degree in geology, wanted to talk about the tension, so-called tension between creation and evolution, which to me is a nonsensical thing. First of all, it's nonsensical because to compare two things, you actually have to understand each of them separately. So none of them understood creation and none of them really understood evolution. So I said, go home, basically, because all you're going to do is confuse yourself. Number one. Number two, it's also a misunderstanding. The Torah is actually, by and large, not interested in mechanism. The Torah is interested in meaning. Why do things happen? Not only why do they happen, but what does this mean for me? What specific behavior must I derive from this story that will push the story itself forward? So that means, okay, great, maybe there was an earthquake at the precise moment that would allow Am Yisrael to go through. By the way, that would in itself be fairly impressive that it happened in that timing, but we'll leave that aside. But it lasted for 6 weeks and they managed to get through in that gap. What do I care? Because if you approach the story that way, then you strip it of any meaning and you fail to appreciate the fact that even if you want to say it's a fairy tale, we've been telling this story for 3,000 years and it has gotten us quite far. And if you take the meaning out of it in some mistaken attempt to base it on sound factual evidence, what you do is you completely remove its power, because the power of the story is actually not in the past, it's in the present and in the future.
Anyway, 100%. Trying to naturalize God is lechalel, is to make it bereft of meaning.
And it is the birth sin of the whole scientific method. Not that I'm not into science, but to think that science can replace God is exactly what that is.
My parents, who are scientists, both told me always, they said, science is the pursuit of figuring out how God created the world.
Yeah.
Or how to use God's world, you know, to do good, more good things.
Mechanism instead of meaning.
No, but their point was is that they're, as Torah-believing Jews who were scientists were like, no, science is not, it's here to follow God.
Yeah.
It's here to be like, okay, you know, like, but it's mechanism, but mechanism with meaning. You
mechanism
know?
In service of. Well, that's the thing is that you don't look to science for the meaning necessarily.
Right. Certainly not. We live in such a mechanized age that you know, technology itself has a form of like value. It's almost like a god unto itself in a sense.
Well, listen, that's for sure. Scientists have become the new priests. I mean, technology, because it can deliver, in many ways, creates a very pagan relationship. I saw a very funny cartoon recently. It was like, the first caption was, the way you think of things. And it showed a person pointing at their phone saying, fetch me my email, order me a pizza, you know, giving all these commands on the phone. And then it said reality. It showed this giant phone and this person bowing down before it. It was saying, you must answer that next email. You must. You know, the reality is who's serving who in that dynamic.
I love my phone. Anyway.
But do you worship it?
I don't worship it, and I find it to
be... I notice it keeps getting bigger every time you come back to America.
It does get bigger a little bit. It does tend to get a tad bigger. But I subdue it with two things, which is airplane mode. At night times, I put on airplane mode, and something which has become, I think, more important today than ever before, and that's the Shabbat.
Shabbos. Right.
And it's amazing how Shabbos has become so much more pertinent today. You would have thought that in the age where work is easier,
yes,
where we've been freed from the labor of the field, and
right,
we wouldn't
just
need
push
as much
a button and it all happens anyway.
Right, nothing happened. What happened? What did you do already? Just answering a phone call. And today you need that Shabbos more than ever. Anyway, the next one is
it's only Monday.
Yeah, the next one is the boils, right? The boils or some kind of skin lesions, some kind of very unpleasant, to the point that the wizards are standing out of this one. They could not stand in front of Moses because this time it got them, and they're in bed or wherever trying to deal with their very unpleasant boils. Do you define it as boils?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
And then, interestingly enough, the one that it says that I'm going to send all of my plagues to your heart is going to be the fiery hail. Fiery hail. Hail, which breaks things, plus fire inside. I guess that one is unique in that it's kind of like, I don't know if it's totally unique, because the first one, the blood, the water turning to blood, is also kind of supernatural in the sense that it couldn't even happen naturally. But this one is like, you see,
it's pyrotechnic,
right? You see, I'm sending hail balls with fire in them. You see what's going on here? Right.
You're not gonna miss this. That one,
right? You do not want this, okay? And it says, God says, I'm gonna send this to your heart. Interestingly enough, one of my favorite verses in this week's Torah portion is this one: V'ulam, and however, Bavur zot he'amadticha. It is for this reason, Pharaoh, that I stood you up, that I made you who you are. Be'avur harotcha et kochi, because I wanted to show you my power. U'leman saper shmi b'chol haaretz. And for this reason, by showing you my power, you're going to tell my name will be told in the whole land. It's for this very reason that I created you, to show off my powers. You're a character in my play, man. And I want you to know this. I wanted you to be, in a sense, it's like there's a determinism here, right? Which is, you know, philosophers and Jewish
struggle with it.
They're gonna struggle with it. But he's like, I set this whole thing up,
yep,
so I could show you my power, boy, and the whole land.
And you know, just two verses earlier, there is the real message for all generations. Meaning, it's all well and good that power should be broken, right? And that's a message for all material empires throughout time. Just know that everything you think that you created for yourself, like it says in Sefer Yechezkel, like the accusation against Egypt is ze yori, right? Ani asiti, right? This is my river. I made it. That is the essence of what Egyptian culture is, which is the essence of what all material culture power is. I made this, right? But the deeper message for us, since we are not masters of the material culture, you and I, it comes one verse earlier, which is ubavur teda. Because you need to know. This is about consciousness. And I'm going to crack the shell of creation as you know it, says God. And there's going to be a new way of knowing that comes in the world, which is that I'm here. I'm here. I didn't make the world and walk away. And even though it's been a long time since Sinai, and it's been a long time since the destruction of the temple, right? You know, this is an incredible moment, because if you think about what we call, you know, Passover, which of course is bound up with this story here, we call it the Festival of Freedom. You know, it's such an important question. How could it be that the Jews have been celebrating a Festival of Freedom in so many places of oppression? That there was a Festival of Freedom in Auschwitz, that there was a Festival of Freedom during the time of the Inquisition, in you know, the Polish ghettos, etc. Where does that freedom come from? It comes from right here. It says, you should just know one thing. I'm here, says God. Now, that may be hard to buy if you're in a difficult situation, but listen, it didn't get more difficult than Egypt. I'm establishing for all time that this is what it means to be a Jew. You must know. Ein kamoni b'kol haaretz. There's no one like me, says God.
And that gives you freedom.
And that is freedom.
Right, no matter what.
And that gives you freedom. It is freedom itself. That consciousness is freedom, because the reality is, you could have all the money in the world. You could live in the most free society in the world. You slip getting out of the bathtub, you break both your legs, and never walk again. How different is that than being trapped by some evil person in a cage? I mean, it's different, obviously, but you get my point. I mean, on some level, the externals of life, even your physical health, are not within your control. The only thing which can be chosen is a chosen consciousness. And this is the anchor for it right here. And it's so important, because we enslave ourselves daily in order to avoid the great fear that comes with freedom. And here it is, God is saying, listen, I don't care what you slave yourself to. You should know, Ein Kamoni, Kol Haaretz, there is nothing like me.
All right, and with that, I think it's a great place to stop. We are halfway through the plagues. There are more plagues to come in next week's Torah portion. Bo?
You don't know Bo.
Huh?
Bo, you don't know diddly.
I don't know.
I couldn't resist.
The drama of the Jewish people's exodus is happening as we read it. And, of course, also we have also entered an interesting mystical period here in Israel. It's all over. It's for Jewish people everywhere, but it's kind of more celebrated and commemorated here in Israel. And that is the Torah portions called Shovavim, or this period called Shovavim, which means that it's actually a few Torah portions, about six of them, that are about cleansing sexual misdeeds or misthoughts. And it's a purification process. We always have something on the calendar, folks. Always.
Yeah,
and
the calendar's never empty.
Right. And the Jewish people, as they're coming out of Egypt, they also have to cleanse themselves of some of the licentiousness which clung onto them as they were in the Egyptian society. So that's another thing that's happening here. I want us all to get into that freedom mindset, into that Exodus mindset. And a lot of people have linked the new American president to a new king in Egypt. This one should be good, and this and that. That's all external. We got to talk about internal release of those bondages that we make for ourselves, that we talked about in different ways on the show today. And also to understand that no matter who the president of the United States is, it's really about our choice, about the Jewish people's choice to move forward. And if anything, it's an opportunity for us to have less bondage to do what we need to do. That's what really this period could be about, which is, will the Jewish people choose to move forward? Will they choose to go from Veheveti to Venatati? God brought us to the land, and will he give us this land? And now we have to actually take it. I want to say hi also to Yechiel out in Efrat, a good friend of mine, been listening to the show for many, many years. God bless him. There's many other folks that I want to say hi to around the world that are part of this great effort to try to broadcast the story. But in any case, Rabbi Mike Foer, I want to thank you so much for being with me here today.
Always a pleasure. Great to see
you. And I want to wish you a great Exodus. All right?
We're moving out, man. We are moving out.
Let's believe our own words. Let's believe the words of the Torah and actually free ourselves from anything that's holding us down. I want to wish you a lot of blessing and success.
Amen.
All right, folks, wherever you are, write me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. Thanks again to the Land of Israel Network. Thank you for being whoever you are, wherever you are. Thanks to Chris for that great email from a Gentile out in Texas. And thank you for your strength to be part of this great story. So don't stop being part of the story. Keep on listening. Keep on rebroadcasting. And stay tuned, because I'll be back with Malka Fleischer right after the break. Rabbi Mike, Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom, Yisrael.
All right, folks. Stay tuned. Stay strong. And Shalom.
The best place to stay in Jerusalem is at Windows of Jerusalem Vacation Apartments. Check out their website, www.windowsofjerusalem.com. They've got beautiful 1, 2, 3, 4-bedroom apartments in the best location in the city center with the most beautiful, breathtaking views. And I mean breathtaking. I've stayed there a number of times myself, and I'm telling you, there are few places anywhere in the city where you can take it all in to this degree. The view, the location, the great apartments, plus the wonderful staff will truly make you feel at home in Jerusalem. Book your stay now at windowsofjerusalem.com.
All right, folks, we're back here on the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world, and you're a part of it wherever you are. Shalom, and welcome to my living room, our living room, overlooking the Temple Mount from the Mount of Olives. As I'm talking to you right now, I look over, and there it is again, the Temple Mount, the Golden Dome that's atop of it, and some kind of 3D holographic image, hologram image of the temple that is not there yet, but just is kind of itching to come down. And that little laugh was from Malka Fleischer, show hostess with the mostest. Shalom, Malka. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ishai. Thanks for having me on again this week.
Thank you for coming on. Speaking of Malka, I want to shout out to one of our biggest fans, Grandpa Walter.
Grandpa Walter. We're always so happy that you're listening out there in Florida.
That's right. And also sending us nice emails. And he gives me chizuk. He gives me strength to hear from him. God bless you, Grandpa Walter, till 120. Be strong out
Amen.
There. We hope to see you again soon. And all the good people out there that enjoy the show and gives them a little chizuk. I love that word, chizuk. I love the word chazak.
It comes from the word chazak, which
chazak.
Means strong.
Strong. I like that word, chazak. I remember talking with a very elderly gentleman who was telling me about early Nazi Germany, that he was there, and they had a soccer team, a Jewish soccer team called Hakoach, the strength.
Hmm.
Anyway, and how they beat the German team one time. It was like this like memory that really shone in his head. And that word, I love that word, chazak. I like that word, chazak. Just got to be strong. You really have to be strong out there. Speaking of giving strength, I got a chance to hang out with another great listener to the show and a great friend, Rabbi Mark Landsman. He's the principal of YCQ in Queens. And he always shows me every time he bumps into me at the Western Wall and today in Hebron and Chevron. He shows me his iPhone and shows me my own show on his
cool.
phone. Yeah, that's fun. That's really fun.
That's really sweet that he would do
that. Yeah, that's really, really fun. And so it was great to hang out with the rabbi. And we toured Chevron today. It was very moving. And there's something about seeing Chevron through the eyes of guests like Rabbi Mark, which... gives me chizuk. It gives me a lot of chizuk. Now, speaking of the chizuk, an incredible story right now that's coming out is that there are reports that the Palestinians are claiming that Obama's last minute $221 million payout that was like surprised everybody after President Obama left the scene, has been frozen by Trump, by the Trump administration, that it's stuck. It's not moving, and that it's pending some kind of examination.
Mm.
Where exactly this money going? Because we all know, everybody knows, that a lot of money that goes to the Palestinian Authority ends up paying out to all kinds of widows of terrorists and to funds for killers in jail, all kinds of horrible, horrible stuff, and all kinds of
terrorist summer camp.
Horrific, horrific, mind-boggling propaganda, blood-curdling propaganda against Israel, against Jews, the murder of
Jews.
And
against America.
And against America. And it's just like, well, you know, everybody knows that that America gives payouts to the Palestinian Authority, but then it's like, but why? But why? And I read an article today in Hebrew by Carolyn Glick. And basically, she's just like, the Trump presidency is in part about asking questions like, why are we doing this? Should we really be doing this? It's like a lot of things that have been taken for granted. For example, like, why shouldn't we recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel? Why not?
Yeah, why is it a big emergency to stop that?
Right. Just because some bullies are talking about that it would open the gates of hell. I don't know why, but that has been a consistently humorous thought in my head, the idea that it's going to open the gates of hell.
I want to know who thinks they get to talk like that also. It's like it's a crazy world out there, I think, when there are people who say things like that, who can say, leaders of groups of people who can say, you do X and I will open the gate of hell on you. There should be, I don't know, that shouldn't be able to happen.
Well, I just, you know, like we have taken it for granted. That America will be somehow supporting that. But it's not what the American people want. It's not what American Congress wants. And now it's not what the American president wants. It's just like nobody wants to support this. Like, how many times do I have to read at Palestinian Media Watch, which is one of the, if you want to get an email from an organization that's going to, it's going to bother you every time you get their email, but still, like, you got to see it. It's like every time Palestinian Media Watch sends me something from the Palestinian Authority where they had some kind of event, and there's Mahmoud Abbas at an event honoring the memory of some horrific murderer And it's like this is what these dudes are up to. Why should we give
them That's what they're about, and they're pretty public about it.
Right, and so $221 million, which is a nice chunk of change, was just like, you know, in the last... By the way, if anybody had any doubts who President Obama was, that's one of the things about him is his legacy. He totally showed his hand who he was. You know, 1, 2, 3, policy speech by Biden against Israel and the settlements, trying to... standing up for basically saying, yeah, we were supportive of the UN... Security Council Resolution 2334, we were supportive of it. And that's why we didn't veto it. They should have just... It's almost like as though they said, yeah, we voted again. We voted for it. We totally voted for it. The Paris Peace Conference, the resolution itself, and this $221 million, like you're just like, this guy is obsessed. He's obsessed with the Palestinian Authority being strong and Israel being weak and criticizing Israel publicly. And suddenly you have a new president who's like, well, I don't accept those things. I don't take them for granted. And I'm not going to give them $221 million. And also, by the way, Israel announced the building of 2,500 more units in the West Bank,
you know,
in Judea and Samaria. And you know what the Trump administration said? Nothing.
Nothing, because they don't care, because right, they're not all up in our business.
Right. The thing that the Trump administration has to do, which would be so awesome, is not do anything. Just get out of our kishkas and let us do
that,
our thing.
You know, I have some relatives, they should live and be healthy, who were very upset, Ishai, with Trump's motto of America first. You know about America first?
Sure.
One of my close relatives, he told me, Google America first and look up the history of this term or of this phrase, America first. So I said, okay, you know, I'm an open-minded person. I Googled America first. And Ishai, interestingly, America first originated back in World War II time amongst people who didn't want to get involved in World War II because they thought that it was going to be just bad for America. And why should America risk the lives of soldiers just for some Jews? And basically, right, there were a lot of anti-Semitic people involved in the America for in the America First
movement,
I guess you could call it. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, as we know, that movement was not the predominant philosophy in America. It did get involved in World War II, but some people are concerned that Donald Trump is just trying to revivify the original America First, and that it all means that he is secretly a big hater of Jews. He's an anti-Semite, like the forefathers of this concept are anti-Semites.
So he hates Ivanka.
And I thought about it. Right. Basically, that was their concern, right? I do not think so. I am not an expert in Donald Trump, and I am not an expert in the politics going on in America today. It just doesn't seem like that to me. And what it seems like to me is that Donald Trump actually just wants America to be thinking about America first, not America only, even just America first. And I think that he seems to me on the foreign policy front to be kind of a libertarian type of guy. Like, if you're not going to be hurting the United States with whatever you're doing, so do what you're doing. It seems to me like he is a friend of Israel, a proponent of a strong Israel in the Middle East. He mentioned radical militant Islam in his inaugural speech and said that he wants to eradicate terrorism. I can get on board with that for sure. And so I don't know. You know what I mean? Trump for sure is a guy who like is off-putting, even to me as a person who likes his policies. He doesn't come off as a gentleman per se, right? He's like very, very coarse. I don't agree with all of his policies. I think that he could be much more nuanced and political, even, I would dare say, about the way that he approaches topics that people care about. I don't think that he cares a lot about being a unifying force. I think that he's like a truth guy and he's just going to tell you the truth, even if it like is like a slap across the face. He's still going to tell it to you as ever he, you know, however he thinks you should hear it. And that's a problem. But in general, I think that he is going to be somebody who gets it about what's going on in the world today, understands the threat of terrorism and of the jihad, and wants for good guys to do well and for threats to that to be put down.
You know what my favorite hotel is, Malika? At the Dead Sea?
No, I don't.
Well, it's not that it's my favorite hotel per se as a hotel, but it's my favorite name of a hotel, which is Lot.
Oh, yeah.
I love the fact that there's a hotel with a biblical name. That's cool. I like it. It's like, because I like themes. Like you, we like themes, right? And I like the biblical theme for Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm excited to announce that Israel and the United States completed tests on the latest version of the David's Sling anti-ballistic missile system today, the defense ministry said. During one of these tests, the defense system's radar array tracked an incoming test missile, calculated its trajectory, and the David Sling launched an interceptor missile that destroyed the target as planned,
nice.
The ministry said. In other words, bang, okay?
Bullseye.
Boom. That is just cool. So I just, yeah.
Happy about David Sling.
I like that
David
name.
Sling
David
is back
Sling.
And
I
better
like
than
that.
Ever.
I like that. I like that. I like that. I like David Sling. I like the name of that. That's good. That's Chazak. By the way, David was recently hauled into court for cutting the head off of Goliath after he had obviously neutralized him. Goliath was on the ground, although some people reported that he moved a little bit. But he had been on the ground, and he was obviously neutralized. And then David came and basically executed him with his head cutting off.
No, Ishai.
And he was hauled into court, where the Jewish people judged him unfavorably for having felled the giant who was Israel's great enemy, but still not showing him mercy at the very last end. So David's on trial. He's now awaiting a
sentencing. Of course, Ishai, you are spoofing the Alor Azariah trial. Alor Azariah, the soldier who in Hebron shot a terrorist who had just stabbed an Israeli soldier who had already been neutralized down on the ground, who may have already been on the way toward his 72 virgins anyway, but instead was definitely sent that direction by Alor, who decided to put a bullet in his head. This has been a source of major national debate over the ability of soldiers to take down terrorists and how far they should go or not go to spare them, to act according to the quote-unquote morality, which says that once a terrorist is down, then now he definitely needs medical treatment and to be treated to the best of Israeli medical care and then have his life saved, or whether he should be taken down, and overreaching all of that, whether a soldier exercising either of those options should face very intense scrutiny and possible jail time. And it looks like, Ishai, the sentencing process has begun, whatever that means. I don't know why it's such a process, but the sentencing process has begun, and the prosecution against him is going to be asking for 3 to 5 years in jail for manslaughter. He was not charged with or convicted of murder. He was convicted of manslaughter by a military court. And now the defense wants the case thrown out entirely because of some inappropriate conversations that officers had with the family, and because what they think it was a quasi-mistrial. And anyway, Alor, as a representative of soldiers all over the country, should be treated with clemency because it is difficult to be an Israeli soldier, and because of the passion of serving for the Jewish people can cause a person to go a little bit overboard sometimes in the service. And for various other reasons, they want the case thrown out. I personally, Ishai, am afraid that this case has become so symbolic and so public that the judges who are in charge of this case and what will happen with it will, who anyway have already convicted him, will give him the maximum sentence. That's what I'm afraid of.
Well, there's two ways to understand the publicness of this trial. On the one hand, it's been a completely shameful, shameful trial. Personally, my biggest critique of what happened with the Elora Azaria case is that it went to a public type trial. Meaning to say, it's one thing to have an internal investigation, ask some questions.
There's nothing wrong with a closed door trial, basically.
Well, I'm saying it could have been an internal investigation, but the way it was handled, here's my analysis, okay? We are at all points in a double war. Every time we engage in conflict here in Israel, we engage today in a dual war. Meaning to say, when Hamas fires a rocket and we fire a rocket back, they're also firing from schools with the hope that we shoot back, and they are ready with their cameras to see some kind of carnage of a child and to air that all over television.
That is a victory to them.
Right. So basically, we are constantly at a double battle. I'll give you other examples. If we decide in Hebron, to close the stores, the Arab stores that are in the Jewish street area because it endangers the small Jewish community there, that's, on the one hand, security smart. But on the other hand, the cameras of the world are using it to describe Hebron as a ghost city. Now, Hebron is not a ghost city, but that one street that is a ghost city, they'll use that as a writ large, this is what's happening on the big scale, although that's a perpetual lie. So meaning to say, you take a defensive measure, but understand that it also has a cost in what I call narrative warfare. Same thing with you build a fence. A lot of people think that building the security barrier in the country is somehow good for security. But on the other hand, it's been very, very damaging for narrative warfare. The image of the fence has been very, very destructive for Israel's PR. The same thing with Elora Azaria. Elora Azaria, there were two battles that were happening at the same time. The first battle was the battle of the terrorists. The terrorists came to kill. The terrorist came to kill Jews, soldiers, Israelis.
He tried.
He came to kill. And he was shot once, twice, three times, whatever, how many times they shot him at first. And then finally, Elora Azaria shot him in the head, executed him in one way or another. But the second battle was just beginning, the media battle. And what happened was that Shovrim Shtika, Breaking the Silence, or other cameras captured him.
Bezalem,
and they aired it. Now here was a second battle. And in this battle, Israel fell right into the trap. We won the first battle. Our soldiers were trained. They shot the guy. Boom. They killed him dead. But in the second battle, which is totally a battle, a total warfare against Israel, we completely lost. We thought that the way to react was to hang our own soldier, the jihadist that came to kill. That's what he came to do. And yet we did that work because some silly video was aired into the world, and we thought that we needed to show the world.
And then only a short time later, when a terrorist came to the Tayelet in Armona Natsiv and ran over a huge group of soldiers, instead of 50 soldiers running at that truck to shoot the terrorist dead who was running people over on purpose. Soldiers were running all over the place trying to run for cover. And part of the criticism was that the Elora Azaria case caused soldiers to second guess themselves. Unless they are 100,000% sure that this is exactly the moment to shoot this person, then they're not going to do it. And that causes a huge endangerment for Israeli people and loss of life.
I was once at a pretty serious altercation with young jihadists, and I did not pull my weapon. A lot of people criticized me after that because I was like concerned: is it worth it? Am I going to get
in
a lot of trouble?
You're a father with children. Right. You can't afford to be.
But the that's one side of the critique, that Israelis will become more, as you say, hesitant to fire. But the other side is, I'm just saying, on the bigger picture is, that's the war. They won the second battle.
Right, and then it became an international news story.
Right, they became international, and we went right into, oh my God, Israel's a moral army, therefore we have to publicly judge our own and condemn our own. And that was a big mistake, and it really weakened the army. Moreover, I want you to know that in Hebron, after the Elora Azaria quote-unquote execution, there was reduced terrorism for weeks and weeks and weeks. Because they saw a video of an Israeli soldier just having mercilessly dealing with merciless people, meaning to say, like Purim, like meaning to say, hanging the bad guy. Oh, but that's exactly what happened on Purim. Oh, my God. That is exactly what happened. On Purim, what Esther asks of Ahasuerus is to take the 10 sons of Haman, who were already dead, and to hang them publicly, right? To make it really...
Make an example of them.
Make an example of them. Any case, so that was what was happening with King David, I guess, and with Esther, and with Elor Azariah. We really hope that everything goes well. Oh, by the way, I had the Washington Post in Hebron. Three reporters, including Loveday something, a famous reporter called Loveday. She's the Iraq bureau chief. And William Booth, the bureau chief here in Jerusalem, from Washington Post. They were all in town, and they were interviewing everybody about the Elor Azariah case. And I brought them to one of our toughest guys, Ashi Horowitz. And he's just like, they're like, well, what do you think Elor Azariah should get? He's like, a medal. And they were just like writing in their little notebooks. I can't wait till that article comes out. but I actually wanted them to see that not all Jews are going to give, you know, these kind of, you know, I knew that Ashi wouldn't give some kind of milquetoast answer. I knew that he would give the tough answer. And I think that's part of the Hebron ethos also. It's of course coexistence. It's of course, you know, building, you know, a beautiful country and giving minorities rights and all that. But it's also tough Jews. And Hebron represents being a tough Jew. I want to recommend everybody to come on our Hebron tour, by going to hebronfund.org and signing up for our tours. There's a lot of people coming in right now. I also want to thank our buddy Jack for helping support the show, continuing to support the show. And he dedicates the show to his wife Lillian and his sister Sarah. Aww. And as Sarah herself helps the show, and Nathan and Moshe, they really help the show happen. And also our good friends, the Michels, out in Switzerland, and also our good friend Donnie, I think, who moved recently to Tel Aviv. A lot of good friends are part of the show. Please check out my new website and let me know what you think. I would love to hear your comments. YishaiFleisher.com. And of course, check out all of our other great shows here on the landofisrael.com network, the Land of Israel Network, landofisrael.com, and many other great shows here. Malka Fleischer, I want to thank you so much, and I want to wish you a great Shabbat Shalom.
Thanks, Yishai. Shabbat Shalom too.
Shabbat Shalom and blessings. It is it's purportedly, supposedly going to be a rainy Shabbat.
Oh man, I hope so. Guys, snow people out there, I got a couple of Facebook messages from people who said that they are happy to share their snow with us, as I asked for last time I was on the show. My children are under pressure now, because here we are, it is almost February, then it's going to be March, and before you know, it's going to be Pesach. Our time is almost up for snow. We haven't even gotten that much rain, truth be told. I don't know about the rest of the country, but for sure here in our part of Jerusalem, it has felt like an extremely dry winter, and for sure no snow. And so I'm asking you to double down on your prayers for snow. We just need a few more degrees on Shabbat to come down, and we could have a white, fluffy Shabbat for the children. So hook us up, people. That's we'll be right. Happy to take your unwanted snow.
Not to mention that the fruits of the land of Israel and the air of the land of Israel all need a little bit more precipitation.
They need more precipitation. And I heard freezing is very good. That's funny.
We need participation for precipitation.
That's right. I heard that freezing is particularly good for grapevines.
Grapevines, absolutely, absolutely.
And Israel is known internationally for its excellent wine, so we need your help.
How about international participation for Israeli precipitation?
Cute.
That's what I'm asking for right now.
I'm
looking for that right now. I'm looking for everybody to be part of this. And that's your Zionism for the week. Your Zionism for the week is to pray for the reign of the land of Israel for real. For real, I want to hear that from you. I want to hear it from you. To G-D, he wants to hear from you. Just dial G-D, okay? and call up. And, of course, it's a long-distance call from outside of the land of Israel, but we will connect you. We will connect you. That is going to be the new slogan of the show.
Operators are standing by.
Operators standing by, and you know, and you'll get this this julienne fry slicer as well. God bless you folks wherever you are. Thank you so much for joining. Write me an email, yeshai@thelandofisrael.com, yeshai@thelandofisrael.com. Please check out the new website, yeshaifleischer.com. If you have any questions for Malka, write her an email as well, just through me, yeshai@thelandofisrael.com.
And don't forget to join Yeshai on Instagram and on Facebook, yes, and on Twitter. And I've started going on Twitter recently, Yeshai.
Malka is
I've been tweeting.
Unstoppable. You can't be stopped.
I can't be stopped. And I'm on Facebook and I'm on Instagram, but not as much. But the point is, you can catch us just about anywhere that you are.
And LinkedIn and YouTube and all of the above. God bless you folks wherever you are. Stay tuned, stay strong, stay connected. Be part of the story. Don't let anybody bring you down. Be strong. Chazak and shalom.
When I was growing up, I would read the books in the second half of the Old Testament, and sometimes I would get a little bit lost in all those prophecies of Jeremiah, Isaiah, and so on. That all changed the day I stepped foot in the land of Israel. As I harvested grapes and olives and more on the mountains of Samaria, the words of the prophets came to life right before my very eyes. Today, you could be a part of this phenomenon too. I am Caleb Waller, and I'm inviting you to step into the pages of prophecy by joining us in Israel. Go to our website, that is hayovel.com, H-A-Y-O-V-E-L.com, to connect to this amazing opportunity.